Idaho versus Mr. Bale Incorporated, docket number 47533. Here on behalf of the appellant, Mr. Bale, is Mr. Tribble. Here on behalf of the state is Mr. Jorgensen. Mr. Tribble, are you prepared to present argument?
Yes, I am, Your Honor.
Go ahead, please.
Thank you. May it please the court. My name is Aaron Tribble. I'm the attorney for Mr. Bale Incorporated, and I have followed this case all the way from its original inception in Magistrate Court of Elmore County into the District Court at Elmore County, and now before the court today. Basically, this, as we've outlined in the briefing, this case comes down to really two main issues, and the threshold issue, of course, is whether or not time should have been extended, allowing the filing of this motion outside the 180-day window. And in the briefing, we went through, and I don't need to regurgitate any of the authority that's in the briefing. I think it speaks for itself that there is supposed to be a, you know, leniency that's afforded bond companies in cases where there's issues that may arise. And I think what we saw in this case was really anything but leniency. And in fact, I've never had an issue like this come up. And I think even the magistrate acknowledged that. And so really hitting on the first point, which is this whole issue of extension of time. And Criminal Rule 45 points it out. In the magistrate hearing, I was operating under the assumption that it was more of a, bonds operate under more of a civil type of rule set. And so I was arguing more along the civil lines. But I think the magistrate court did correctly understand where I was going with it, and even made several comments to the effect of excusable neglect and good cause for extension of time and things like that. He didn't ultimately conclude that there was good cause and excusable neglect. However, I think it was understood that that was the whole point of being there and filing the motion at all beyond the 180-day deadline. As far as the threshold issue is concerned, the reason for this appeal is really was the ruling within the bounds of the magistrate's discretion. And within the bounds, given the fact that he had accepted certain facts during the course of the proceedings. And in looking back at the transcript from the original hearing, magistrate made a few comments that I think were really, really telling and were ultimately why I believe that Mr. Bale should...
Mr. Tribble, sorry yes. to interrupt you. What transcript are you referring to?
I am referring to the magistrate hearing. Should be page...
What date?
That is a good question. And here's where I think I had the note on my iPad and I didn't transfer it over to my phone. If I'm remembering correctly, it was in July of 2018. I can't remember the exact date.
Okay, that's fine, thank you.
Is that okay? I apologize. I had to transfer my notes from my phone to my, or from my tablet to my phone at the last second. Because my Zoom wasn't working on my phone. Well, basically, the page I'm concerned with is bottom of page 16 to the top of page 17, where the magistrate says, the court agrees that this is somewhat, well, this issue doesn't happen very often, where a motion is not filed within 180 days as required by the statute. It just generally does not happen. And it is rare for a bonding company or the surety company to not file as required with 180 days. I believe that this was an oversight and, as stated by counsel, neglect by the company, and that this is the first time this has ever happened for specifically this bail company. And I think in accepting a fact such as that, where it's just a simple human error, putting information from a notice of forfeiture that's sent and entering it into a spreadsheet, where there is this fundamental basic human error that occurs, and it's the first time it's ever happened, is literally unprecedented. And at that point, the judge is more or less bound his own discretion by saying that I accept that this was neglect. I accept it was the first time. So at that point, Mr. Bale's position is that this is, it would be an abuse of discretion to say that it wasn't excusable neglect and to rule any other way.
Mr. Tribble, yes. What the magistrate ruled was that it was neglect, but that it was not excusable because the magistrate had warned you earlier that the $10,000 bond was outstanding?
Yes, yes, exactly. And I think that really belies what was happening here, which is we had something that was neglect, but the fundamental assumption at the company, because of their procedures, was that they enter this into the spreadsheet and they trust that their procedures have been followed. So they always are trusting that their spreadsheet is correct, that it's going to alert them to dates that come up and you know, when there's a filing deadline that needs to happen. And so really, even though, yes, I also did that hearing where the judge did alert them to the fact of the $10,000 bond that we're now talking about. And I understand that, yes, it was an alert, but even at that time, they were alerted, but in the back of their heads, they're thinking, well, I don't need to take any further action because my spreadsheet has it. There's just this underlying trust that they've had their procedures followed. And for hundreds and thousands of times, like Mr. Elliott testified, that was always the case and they'd never encountered a problem. So I think once that threshold issue is resolved, I think then we get to the point of the amount. And this is where I think the magistrate really came down to it's an abuse of discretion on the second issue because it's not an exercise of reason. I think what we saw in his analysis was ultimately from the transcript, it came down to a matter of the magistrate wanted to send a message and make sure that this was about deterrence. And when really giving no weight to the other factors involved in this 46H test that's supposed to occur. And I think those other factors were that, well, I mean, first of all, the man was bonded out by Mr. Bale, picked up only a couple of days later, I think, was only out for maybe 2 or 3 days. And then this warrant from Owyhee County came out. They actually picked him up in Elmore, arraigned him on fugitive status, and then sent him out to Owyhee. And at that point, I mean, he was in the custody of the Owyhee County Sheriff. The warrant from, he failed to appear in Elmore, and then the warrant was issued. That was served on him in Owyhee, so he was made aware, the sheriff was made aware that he's supposed to get shipped back to Elmore after the Owyhee proceedings were concluded. So he really was, there was nowhere left for this man to go. There was nothing for the company to do. And I'm not even sure deterrence really comes into play when at that point, everything that could have possibly been done to bring this man back to justice had taken place. And in fact, most of it was really out of the bond company's hands. Once law enforcement had him, it was basically over at that point. So, and the number, the 10,000, in going back and looking at the transcript doesn't seem to correlate at all with the actual incurred costs by the state, which would be witness issues, transport issues, other things that ultimately would, you know, would come up to a number, like, you know, a typical, you know, for instance, a typical number might be like $1,000 bond on a DWP or something. And, you know, with witness issues and transport issues and various things, I mean, you can eat up that $1,000 very quickly. But in this case with $10,000, I think the prosecutor at the time really couldn't come up with more than just a couple of different reasons to withhold that money. So, 10,000 seemed to be well beyond the pale, and it didn't seem to really pass the test of how does this add up? And ultimately that's where Mr. Bale's position has landed, which is this really an exercise of reason? Because it seems to be more of a deterrent punitive type of thing, which ends up as a windfall to the state, than it is really doing anything to reimburse the state for the fact that he failed to appear. It's not reimbursing for witness issues or anything. It just goes completely above and beyond. That's really the crux of what I have to say today. I'm going to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal unless there's any immediate questions.
Mr. Tribble, I do have a question.
Yes.
Have articulated for us how you believe the magistrate court erred. Could you explain to us how you believe the district court erred?
I think, yes, the district court, the concerns in the district court were, I guess, a bit baffling to me when during the questioning, and in looking back through the transcript, it also seemed apparent to me that the district court was very concerned that I did not file a motion in advance of the 180-day deadline. And I'd say it was baffling because if Mr. Bale had known about the spreadsheet error, then they would have discovered it. If they had known about it in advance of the 180-day deadline, then they would have filed it on time anyway, and they wouldn't have filed for an extension of time. They would have just simply filed a motion under Idaho Code 19-2917. And at that point, they would just ask for exoneration based upon the factors that I've just discussed. And so there wouldn't be any reason to ask for an extension of time if you knew the error existed and it was in advance of the 180-day deadline. You'd just go ahead and ask for the exoneration. So I think there was a misunderstanding by the district judge as far as that the spreadsheet error sort of necessarily meant that it would be filed after that deadline, because nobody realized there was an error until after the forfeiture notice showed up from the court saying, pay your $10,000 bond. And that's when we acted. That's when we acted. That's when the motion to exonerate was filed. I think that seemed to be the key right there to the why the district judge acted the way that she did. And she ultimately upheld just based upon the fact that, you know, it wasn't filed within the deadline, and didn't see a reason to even get to the next analysis, because she felt like the motion was something that should have been done before 180 days instead of after 180 days, which was the original purpose of the motion to begin with. So I guess it was baffling, but at the same time, seemed to be sort of a misunderstanding on my part. I tried to explain as best I could, but hopefully that was apparent from the transcript.
So your position is that the district court did not address whether or not the neglect was excusable?
If I'm remembering correctly, with the district court, it was not addressed as to whether or not it was excusable, in the sense that they felt like they couldn't even get to that analysis because the motion was not filed within the 180-day limit, which I believe the Rule 45 allows for it to be filed before the 180-day limit, but the excusable neglect analysis only applies to a motion filed after the limit, or after whatever time limit has expired.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Anything further, Mr. Tribble?
No, I'll reserve the rest of my time.
Thank you. Mr. Jorgensen, is the state prepared to go forward?
Yes, Your Honor. May it please the court. Mr. Bale has failed to show error by the district court in its appellate review of the magistrate's rulings. The magistrate ultimately denied the motion on two grounds. First off, that it was filed untimely and without excusable neglect. And second, that the weighing of the factors provided in the rule ultimately did not lead the court in its discretion to grant the motion and exonerate the bond. This court could affirm on either of those two rulings. The district court, of course, affirmed solely on the timeliness issue without reaching the merits, and certainly an appellate court may do so. When a lower court rules on two grounds and one of them is sustainable on appeal, there is no reason to reach the merits of the alternate holding. In this particular case, the motion for exoneration was untimely. There's no dispute about that. The notice of forfeiture went out on November 15th, 2017, and the motion to exonerate was not filed within 180 days. It was filed approximately 197 days later. The reason that the magistrate said that the neglect was inexcusable was that Mr. Bale, in fact, had notice of everything, of all of the facts necessary to make its claim and file its motion on March 26, 2018. And of course, it's rather rare that we actually have a hearing in which a court basically tells a party that you have another claim. It's not currently before me, but it's based upon the same facts as the current motion, essentially. So that's exactly what happened. Mr. Bale knew on March 26, 2018. So it had multiple opportunities to make sure that its spreadsheet or whatever other tracking mechanism it had in place was current and up to date. It should have done it back in November. It certainly could have done it in March, or it could have just proceeded straight to filing the motion in March when after the proceedings in court happened. They certainly had notice, and they certainly had the ability to do it. So that brings two reasons why the neglect was not excusable neglect. And that is that we have found factually, and there's really no reason to dispute these facts, that Mr. Bale had ample notice that it needed to file its motion about 2 months before it in fact filed its motion. In addition, even if there was some sort of calendaring error in this particular place, the fact that they knew that they had to file a motion but chose instead to wait until the very last day just isn't excusable. Why would somebody who knows they need to file a motion say, well, you know what, we could file that today, but we'll instead wait for our tracking software to tell us to file it at the last minute? That neither way is that excusable neglect. As for the way the magistrate ultimately found facts that are not disputed on appeal, as to each of the factors set forth in the applicable rule, it then weighed those factors. Now, as I understand the argument, it is that Mr. Bale is unsatisfied with the weighing. And ultimately, that is something within the trial court's discretion, not the appellate court's discretion to do. Mr. Bale is inviting this court to reweigh the factors, and that is not an abuse of discretion review. The abuse of discretion review looks at the four standard factors, and reweighing the factors is not one of those elements of the claim. So ultimately, that claim is not a viable claim. It's simply a request to reweigh the factors and for this court to reach its own result independent of the trial court's application of the legal standard. Under either of these, the state would submit that the order of the district court, the appellate court, can be affirmed based upon either the district court's affirmation of the magistrate court's determination that the motion was untimely, or this court could also reach the merits and rule on that basis that there's been no showing of an abuse of discretion. Therefore, the state does request this court affirm the district court's appellate decision.
Thank you, Mr. Jorgensen. Mr. Tribble, further argument?
Yes, Your Honor. Just trying to pull up. As far as the issue of timeliness is concerned, I mean, I brought this immediately to the magistrate's attention, and this is in the transcript where, after the presentation of evidence, we had argued to the court. And and my comments were, so basically, to begin with, I will just say that this case has obviously been filed untimely due to the reasons that have been presented today, namely the spreadsheet, the tracking that they do on each case. I mean, so right up front, I mean, I was acknowledging to the court that, yes, I know it's untimely, but here's why. Here's the reasons why it's untimely. It wasn't an issue of, you know, it wasn't an issue of, oh, well, I filed it untimely, but I didn't know it at the time when I did it. No, we knew exactly what was going on, which is why we put on evidence to show that this was excusable neglect. Now, the general practice when it comes to the bail bonds, and this I did explain some in the briefing, but basically you've got that 180-day limit, but nobody files a motion to exonerate after 3 months. And the reason is because you can't properly weigh the factors. A judge or the fact finder cannot cannot look and see whether or not you've actually done everything that you can to bring this person into court when you've only spent, say, 90 of those 180 days doing the work, you know, trying to apprehend this person or you know, get motions to transport or whatever it is that needs to be done. And in this case, that is basically everything that had been done. And so we're just waiting to see if this person is going to be done in a why he filed the transport motion, get him back over. So I would say I've done maybe one or two motions where we filed extremely early, like maybe 1 or 2 months ahead of the deadline. And it's usually denied. I think at least one of those couple times was denied, just because there's just no, the court's saying, well, okay, you're just kind of looking for a handout. I want you to do your job and bring this person into court. So, I mean, that's why the practice exists for these bond companies to wait until usually the last week before that 180-day deadline is up. Now, again, I think the notice is, what's happening with the spreadsheet is it's basically their calendar. That's how they're tracking hundreds, if not thousands, of bonds simultaneously. So they're just making a calendar entry. And I mean, I get that you can, you know, you tell a person, hey, don't forget, this is going to happen. This is coming up. And most people think to themselves, well, it's in my calendar. I don't need to go back and double check my calendar again because I know my calendar is correct. And that's exactly what happened. And it's really what the magistrate acknowledged is this has happened hundreds or even 1,000 times and you've never messed it up until now. And so, yeah, I think people rely on their calendars. People assume that their calendars are correct because they put that information in there. And that's exactly what happened in this case. And so, yeah, you know, 999 times out of 1,000, that's worked, but this one time it didn't work. And so I think, is it reasonable to assume that somebody could make a mistake like that? Absolutely, because people rely on that type of information being in the spreadsheet and being done the way it's always been done, 999 times out of 1,000, or at least up until that point, had never been wrong. So yeah, is it excusable neglect? I think absolutely, because it had never happened before. It's completely unprecedented. Now, as far as reweighing the factors, I think, yes, I think a reweighing is necessary where the overall result doesn't fit the facts that it came out of. And so I'm like, yes, it results in a windfall. This was what started as a DWP, just a second offense, driving without privileges, and he failed to appear. The judge put a $10,000 bond in place, or required him to post $10,000. Which he posted, got out, and now we're here. But I think to tie that, the $10,000 is the incentive for the bond company to get him back into court. It's not representative of anything that has to do with the case as far as an amount that it's going to cost the case to put on, or cost the state to put on their case. It's not representative of any of the other costs that are involved in the delay that occurs when somebody fails to appear. So the facts don't match the ultimate amount. Driving without privileges is a one witness case to try. You've got the person in custody. All you got to do is bring them from a Waihi to Elmore, and then bam, the case is done just like that. So the impact on the state is minimal. There's really nothing that even really adds up to 10,000 or even close to 10,000. So I think because of that, just looking at it from 30,000 feet, I think you can easily conclude that it's just the facts don't match the amount. It's a windfall is really what it comes down to. So I think there needs to be a reweighing in that.
But Mr. Trimble, it shouldn't, I mean, your company was on notice that this individual failed to appear 4 times on a $2,500 bond. And yet your company was perfectly happy when he gets brought back into court to post bail for him again, knowing that he'd failed to appear 4 times in a row. So I guess I'm curious about why and what authority you provide when you argue that leniency should go in favor of the bail bonds when they're making calculated gambles, basically, about whether they're going to have to pull people back in or not.
Yes, I think there's always that going on. And I think it's not just the bond company that's making that calculation. I mean, ultimately, it's the judge that's deciding how much is it going to take to get this person back into court. And so The judge also was part of that equation and decided that $10,000 now is what it's going to be for you to post and for me to believe that you're going to come back in here. And
your company could have said, gosh, you're too much of a risk. You didn't appear four different times on a $2,500 bond. Why would you appear at all?
I think they rely on the court to say that if $10,000 is the number and we can get this person to qualify and it's actually something that we believe that we can keep a handle on, then, I mean, that's the risk that they're trying to take is do we feel that we can keep a handle on this guy and keep a close enough watch on him to make sure that he's going to get back? Now, I can definitely within my mind think that you would never expect to bond somebody out on a DWP, even for $10,000. You don't expect them to bond out and then go commit murder in Owyhee County. Like, that is like very unprecedented. So, I mean, the bond company was never expecting something like that and having to be completely unavailable to get to Elmore because he's being held for, I think, more than a year in Owyhee County. So that's certainly would have been a very remote risk in the bond company's mind to think that he would have done something like that. And only 2 or 3 days after bonding out for the $10,000. So, I hope, does that answer your question?
I think. Well, I was just wondering, I recollect that you had said earlier that their bail bonds should be treated with leniency, but I don't recollect any authority for that proposition.
Again, I would have to pull up my brief. I believe I cited one Idaho case and another Ninth Circuit case in the first, I think it was paragraph or so of the argument section when it came, I believe it was in the argument section of the brief, first couple paragraphs in there. It was talking about how forfeiture is frowned upon and leniency is recommended in matters of forfeiture, just because it's the state does rely heavily on these bond companies to bring these people back into court. Otherwise, the state would just have to house them in a jail until it's time to bring them to justice, bring them to trial or whatever may happen. And so, I mean, the object here is not to punish the bond companies for what happens. The judge is setting the amount. And I mean, ultimately, the bond company is trying to weigh the risk. How much are we going to have to spend surveilling this person and making sure they get in versus how much are they paying us in a premium to get out? So they felt that it was worth the risk. But I mean, in this case, I think it's really hard to foresee anybody doing what this man did.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Anything further, Mr. Tribble?
I have nothing further.
Questions from the panel? All right, thank you. The court appreciates the briefing and argument in this case. The case is now fully submitted to the court. We'll issue an opinion in due course. Court will be in recess until October 22nd.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.